Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Welcome to Unified. This is a show where we listen, learn and laugh and meet people from different and diverse backgrounds all over Ireland. We hear their stories and perspectives. I'm your host, Momobo Ogoro, and you can get in touch with Unified at unified@newstalk.com. That's Unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up on today's show, we discuss the future of accessible technology for visually impaired and blind people. On What's Your Story, we're joined by Palestinian artist Tuka Al-Sarraj, who joins us to explore the role of her heritage in her installations and artistic practice. And on the social scene, we'll be talking about how live music shows can become more welcoming and inclusive for autistic artists and audiences. But first, technology is transforming the everyday lives of people who are blind or visually impaired. From AI assistants that describe the world in front of them to apps that connect users with volunteers in seconds. And technology is even making comic books more accessible, folks. But with these innovations emerging, how do we know which tools are generally useful? And what does the future of accessible technology look like? Well, I'm joined today by David Redmond, technology trainer and digital content creator at Vision Ireland, and Sean Doran, head of technology at Vision Ireland Labs, to explore the right tools and supports for people who are visually impaired and blind. Welcome, folks. So, David, there's one stat that I was reading that around 18 people every day in Ireland begin to lose their sight. That is profound. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's huge. People don't consider the fact that, you know, in Ireland in total, at the last census, there was around 297,000 people who are blind or visually impaired. And that can be made up of all sorts of things. So, you know, there are people, obviously, who lose vision as they age. That's, you know, very common with things like age-related macular degeneration and different conditions like that. But then there's a whole gamut of, I suppose, younger people as well who also have vision impairments and blindness as well. It affects and can affect anyone. And that's the thing that I think sometimes people don't realise, because oftentimes, depending on the level of vision, it can be a visible disability, but it can also sometimes be an invisible disability and people, you know, struggle away in the background.
And I think there's a lot of what you said. It's really profound that it affects anyone in any age at any time. So it's really profound how that can actually impact people. And I know in terms of your story and how this has impacted your life. Can you share with the audience a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been visually impaired since birth. It runs in my family. So my mom would have no vision and my dad would have a little bit of usable vision. So I kind of landed in the middle between the two of them. So I have no vision on my left side, and then I've got a little bit of usable on the right. So what a normal person would see around 60 metres away, I'll see about a metre away. So what that means for me day to day is I will use technology like a screen reader, for example. I would use a white mobility cane to get around. So I will be in the category where my vision impairment, I suppose, is very visible. I can't hide it. So there are people with different conditions that have all different levels of vision. It's a true spectrum and it impacts everybody slightly differently, I guess.
And I suppose the work of Vision Ireland and Vision Ireland Labs is using, like you said, technology as tools to support those who are visually impaired and to have access to treat their everyday lives, for example. So can you tell us more about Vision Ireland Labs?
Yeah, absolutely. So Vision Ireland Labs, or VI Labs for short, is the technology wing of Vision Ireland. So you summed it up pretty well. So what we do is we try to find different solutions to assist someone with achieving just the normal things that they do, whether that's in day-to-day life or, you know, for leisure, but also in the workplace, things like that. So we work to find technology that is specific to them. And we also do a whole variety of other things and try kind of create new technologies where technology hasn't existed previously for people. So we do a huge amount in Vision Ireland, and we are there's no other service quite like it as far as technology is concerned in Ireland, which is really cool to be a part of that.
And that's quite unique, David. And Sean, you're the head of technology. Why is technology so needed, especially for those who are visually impaired?
Well, it's like David was saying, that people with visual impairments have amazing talent and amazing abilities themselves. They just need that extra little bit of help to prove and show their talents, and technology just helps bridge that gap. Stuff that we would see as everyday conveniences of technology is a massive leap forward for people with certain disabilities to allow them to access work, education, etc.
And can you give us examples of like what kind of technologies that are needed to do that everyday access? And probably David can chime in as well.
Well, David did mention his screen reader there. It's probably the most paramount thing for someone with sight loss. A blind person would use a screen reader, and now it's going to navigate through your, whether it's a voiceover on your phone, or it's JAWS on your laptop. That's going to navigate through the environment and the platform to allow you to access certain materials. It's then going to interact with apps and features on those websites or the platform itself to allow you to complete tasks. And a screen reader just steps through, and you can jump ahead into certain sequences and access the things the way we would use a mouse or a finger, either using keyboard shortcuts or gestures on your phone. And it's just so important that we make apps and websites accessible and everything is labeled correctly to allow a screen reader to be completely usable, because obviously I work with a lot of blind and visually impaired people, and all day at work, you know, we're sending emails, in and out of meetings, in and out of spreadsheets, and then you go home and you can't order a pizza online because someone hasn't made that app or website fully accessible. So a screen reader can't access certain buttons, or there's no label for certain buttons, and you don't know what you're actually clicking or trying to do. And it's just so important from a screen reader point of view that we think about those things.
And it's so important. Thank you so much, Sean, for that. Like, many people don't necessarily think about these things when they're just going about their day-to-day life. And it's so important that these technologies are available, like you said. And I suppose, David, within your work in Vision Ireland, you train and you support via content creation, and specifically supporting people in trying to find a solution that is for them. How does Vision Ireland actually do that?
Yeah, so what typically happens, and there are a few different ways that can happen, but if I take the most basic one, let's say someone has been newly diagnosed with a vision impairment. They'll start off by coming to us. They may enter at any point. They might meet one of our CRWs, so they're our community resource workers. And they will go through things, and they can, direct them to us in technology. But sometimes they may also, if they have a need, just call our technology help desk. And that's open 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. They can call with any query to that. And what we can often then do is say, okay, this person could benefit from a technology assessment. So we will meet the person one-on-one. Maybe there might be a family member present, if that makes someone more comfortable. And we can go through their needs. What do they like doing? What are their hobbies? What are their interests? What technology do they use already? And we will go through all of that. And oftentimes, the fascinating part is the technology that someone might have already, be that their phone or their television or a smart speaker in their house, that stuff can often be adapted quite quickly. And then if we need to move on to specialist technology, we absolutely can. But that bridge between, you know, mainstream technology, which traditionally was quite inaccessible, and now you're just able to use basically whatever you have already, and that can be adapted for you at low or no cost, that's a huge enabler for people. So we work with what they have, and it's about finding out, you know, what they want to do, because as we said, everyone's needs different.
And it's so important to have that sort of bespoke support for people that are going through this for the first time, or people that need further supports as they're engaging
Absolutely.
With Vision Ireland. And I know that like we're going through like an AI, artificial intelligence boom. Everyone's talking AI. When you hear the word tech, AI. I want to know, Sean, how has AI impacted the work that you do in the labs?
Well, it's very important. I mean, we go to a lot of tech conferences, and when AI is mentioned, it can be quite negative. Oh, AI is going to remove jobs from creatives. AI is going to do this. AI is going to do that. But we look at how it benefits people with disabilities. And it's the first time that someone who is blind and visually impaired can make a logo or an infographic for their website or their PowerPoint presentation. It helps people create things that they couldn't create before. And it's also helping bridging the gap, especially with likes of wearable technologies. AI on the go is just so important for people with sight loss. I mean, there's technology that's very old called optical character recognition, and you can take a picture of text and it'll read it back. And to some people, that seems very advanced. But with AI, you know, that can summarize that text. Because if you're in a restaurant and you take a picture of a menu, you can spend 5 minutes having to read through that menu with optical character recognition. AI can summarize that, and I can say, tell me the fish dishes, tell me the vegetarian dishes, and it's going to take that immediately from that picture of a menu. And we've been building apps around that technology. What people would see as a convenience, like we were saying earlier, is so useful for people with sight loss.
And that's so important. Like a lot of people, again, don't think about these sort of things in terms of even making certain situations or experiences faster in terms of its output. And can you tell me the difference between like how AI can support in terms of the standard image recognition apps?
So standard image recognition, like most people on websites will have filled out all text themselves and give a brief description. And that's down to the user if that's good or bad. And often in cases, it's very, very mundane. It doesn't describe exactly what's happening. AI can give a bit more detail. But also because it becomes conversational, if you're in a WhatsApp family group, like we've built an application called Savvy where you can take pictures or send images to via share sheets in your messages, etc. So if you had a WhatsApp family message group and someone sent a picture of a wedding, you know, you might know it's a picture of a wedding. Someone might have described it that way. But AI, I can then go into real details of, well, what color suit is the groom's wearing? Does everyone look happy in the picture? What else is there? I can have that conversation back and forth and get more information. Like a picture paints 1,000 words, but all text or a brief description won't. So a person will be able to converse and get that information from and about the image.
And that's really incredible to hear. And hearing about the Savvy AI assistant as well, David, have you tried it? Have you used it? Can you tell us your experience?
I have been trying it and testing it and breaking it and doing wonderful things with it a lot.
Brilliant.
Savvy is really cool. And we'll have Savvy coming out really soon. There are so many things that Savvy can do, and it's really cutting edge. You know, you can, to Sean's point there, you know, share that image of a wedding from the WhatsApp group, but it could be a poster for a concert that you want to go to, and you can just quickly ask, you know, what the dates are, what the cost is. You can quickly get this information. Savvy is also, for the first time ever, it's going to be the first app of its kind to support the Irish language. Which is really cool. There was a huge amount of work went into that. And that means that, you know, let's say someone is doing their homework for the Leaving Cert, they're doing their Irish orals, and they have got, you know, those, you know, visual comprehensions like the Shra Pictori or whatever the case may be. Savvy will be able to help with that. And that's something that hasn't been accessible to blind or visually impaired people previously. And there was a need for a solution. And when the solution didn't exist, we went and we built it.
That's incredible in terms of hearing how in the Irish language, because you never think about that in terms of these solutions in Irish, for example. So Savvy is doing incredible work to ensure that it's accessible to everyone. And specifically that example that you gave, David, in terms of being able to participate in exams or being able to participate in reading in everyday life, it seems like this is just revolutionary in terms of how it's supporting people. And particularly on the point of reading, how can Savvy and other apps like this support those who are visually impaired or blind to read?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's loads of different ways. So you can scan text, so you can just take a picture of something. So that could be brilliant if, let's say, you get a letter in the post, maybe it's an appointment letter, and that can be read back to you using your phone's camera. There are other solutions as well outside of Savvy. And this comes back to the point of, you know, the right solution for everyone. Some people prefer to use smart glasses now. To ask those questions and have that information read back to them. But we've also worked on other services.
What is smart glasses?
Yeah, absolutely. So smart glasses are basically, they would look like a standard pair of glasses, like sunglasses, for example. Now, they don't make you see better physically, but what they often do is they have a little camera on them. So these were usually, or traditionally, I guess, designed for people making videos for Instagram and so on and so forth. But what you're able to do with them with a vision impairment, or if you're blind, is you can just ask these glasses, read this to me or describe this to me. And they will take a photo using the camera and the glasses and describe that back to the person. So there is, when I say there's really cool technology out there, there really
is. So cool.
Like that, I suppose, using the visual example, I'm reading something physically, like that, those appointment letters. That's one example. We also do have reading services for those who want to, say, read books or audiobooks or whatever. So one of our other apps that we're working on at the moment is called Vera, the Vision Ireland Reader app. And Vera is basically going to be able to take loads of books that can be accessed online and convert them into audio and other accessible formats. And that will be available for those who are blind or visually impaired, but also those who have print disabilities, like dyslexia, for example. So there's so much, and these little innovations, they start off with people who are blind or visually impaired, but they can help so many people.
It's reminding me of that piece of when you make something accessible, it's not just for the person that you're making it for, it's for everybody involved. Because like you said, the Vera app can be used for those who may have dyslexia or those who may need support in just terms of reading in general. So it's something that's designed for a unique experience, but in terms of it being accessible to all, it makes the experience better for everybody. So this is really what equitable, I don't know what language I want to use, but equitable technology solutions or something.
There you go.
And I suppose for you, Sean, in terms of even apps such as Vera and Savvy, and looking ahead, what are you looking or hoping to build in terms of technology solutions for those who are visually impaired?
Well, the next part of the Vera application is a comic book solution, because we have a lot of low vision people in our organization. So they can access through Bookshare and download a comic book and magnify that to a level that they can read it. But we want that to be available to people who are completely blind. So we're using AI solutions around that too. And we've built a couple of proof of concepts around this, where we can download the comic book from our Bookshare. It sends it across to an AI, and the AI will read the 22, 30 pages in that comic book. It will assign each character's unique voices. It'll narrate it. So it'll send back what's basically a radio play of describing that comic book cell by cell, detail by detail, in a fun, adventurous way. So each character has their own unique voices created, and it describes the action as it happens. And this is the first time that blind and visually impaired kids will be able to fully experience a comic book, because it's a medium that's so visual, and the art is telling the story, that we want to use, you know, AI to describe what's happening so that every kid can experience those stories growing up.
And that is so cool. And what really stuck out to me was how there's going to be the different characters and the different voices. It's not just a monotone voice. It's really bringing the story to life. And it's something that is so necessary for particularly young adults and children that want to experience comic books, like you said. And as we close this portion of the podcast, I want to ask you a question. So if there's anyone listening, and maybe somebody that they love or somebody that they have engaged with that has experienced sight loss, what advice would you give them? I'm particularly directing them to you, David. And where can they turn to for support? I know Vision Ireland is there, but
yeah,
more broadly as well.
Yeah. So look, I'm going to give two pieces of advice here, right? The first is that when you're diagnosed with a vision impairment or any kind of thing like that, it's legitimately terrifying, and that's okay. It can be a really, really daunting thing to face, and that's absolutely normal. What I would say, though, and it can be difficult to hear when you're hearing it for the first time, but it's valuable to hear, you can live a really fulfilling, happy, successful life with a vision impairment or blindness. That is absolutely achievable. This world of, and we're just talking about technology today, but there's also a whole other world of, sport, entertainment, all of these things, all of that does exist. you know, technology for its part is only going to keep getting better. We'll have, you know, self-driving legitimately before long. You know, we're seeing that kind of technology in the States now. We're seeing all of this, you know, move forward at rapid pace. So all of that is going to lead to a point where we are going to be able to be truly independent. So it's always going to be scary. That's absolutely, you know, normal. But there are solutions out there and it can be okay. That would be my first point. The second point is, and this is to what you were saying, Momobo, it's so important to reach out for support. You know, I'm going to say that Vision Ireland is a great starting point. You don't need a doctor's note or anything like that to refer yourself. You can go onto our website, vi.ie, and you can refer yourself or a family member can do that for you. You don't need permission. You can call us anytime. And there is legitimately support there from us and others. So look, that's the best advice I can give. It's those two points is A, that it can be managed, it can be okay. And B is that, you know, there is the support there. Those would be my two things. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, David and Sean. Again, folks, that was David Redman and Sean Doran from Vision Ireland and Vision Ireland Labs joining me on the show. After the break, we'll hear from a Palestinian artist based in Dublin who's using her artist practice to convey Palestinian culture and heritage in her work. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, what happens when your home becomes a memory? For Palestinian artist Tuka Al-Sarraj, art has become a way of preserving the people, place and stories that shape identity. Through performance, textiles and installations, she weaves together personal memories of Gaza with her life in Ireland, creating work that explores exile, belonging and the power of cultural storytelling. She joins us today on What's Your Story? Hello, Tuka. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you here. Now, can you tell us a bit more about your artistry and where that actually comes from?
It comes from the family. My aunties studied art. Two of my aunties studied art in Iraq. And I grew up on their paintings in our house. And it was just always inspired me. And on the other hand, as Palestinian, I always felt there is ways of freedom to kind of express when it comes to art.
That's beautiful. And it sounds like it's a mixture of the heritage versus like your family, but also the culture as well. And how do you mix that within the work that you do?
It's a good question. Yeah, I think it comes a lot in my practice with the idea of family archives and memory and the personal memory. Through the personal memory, you could express more about the collective memory of Palestine. So that was my focus for, it comes in and out from my practice. You always kind of feel the pressure as Palestinian who grew up under occupation to express and tell the stories through art and culture.
And how does that pressure make you feel?
You always feel like honored to kind of find ways to express and be part of the international kind of art movement and have a Palestinian voice to, I have to say, like, being in Ireland was kind of eye-opening. Like, being in Ireland was always kind of inspiring, how to see home from the exile lens. So that definitely shaped part of my practice in a way while being here.
And what does home look like from the exile lens?
Big question. It's the complex of exile, definitely. But at the same time, you feel like you connect with so many other Palestinians who are exiled from home with the uncertainty of the right to return or going home for over 78 years since Nakba. When you are in exile as a Palestinian, as a woman, as an artist, you kind of bring home where you are to kind of keep you connected in a way. And it has a different voice to it in a way.
That's beautiful. I think it's keeping those memories of home. What I'm hearing from you is that keeping those memories of home alive, whether it's those painful memories, whether it's memories of joy, whether it's memories of freedom, it sounds to me that you're keeping those memories alive through your practice and through your art, which is a really beautiful thing. And can you explain to us and those who are listening, like, some of the projects that you're working on in terms of your practice right now?
Yeah. So I had a project going on. It's an ongoing project in research for the last 4 years. I call it kind of Gaza memory as a practice. And I was connecting ideas of my childhood memory in Gaza and how to express that through the making of art, or like mainly installation and archival stories. And I had an exhibition earlier this year at the Project Art Center. It was part of a Week for Palestine festival. And I was able to kind of present two pieces. One was Meet Me Under the Jasmine Tree, which was like an interactive performance piece. And I had another piece where it was, it's called A Sound from Gaza, which is, I'll explain more. So Meet Me Under the Jasmine Tree was an interactive performance where I had three different jasmine trees and I was inviting people to join me for tea and conversations about home. And I was recreating a scene from home where we had a jasmine tree and we were living in one of the main streets of Gaza, and we would have our friends and family, and there would be times we're sitting under the jasmine tree having tea, talking like normal conversations about, you know, sometimes it was a lot to do with what's going on in Palestine, definitely. But there is the humanization side of Palestinians, that we have another side of it too. We're trying to kind of have a moment and I kind of forget about the occupation, even for a moment over a cup of tea. And it was a tricky one, because while doing this interactive performance, it was a lot to kind of digest and research after and look back to. But yeah, I really enjoyed doing it. And so many people were like, you know, inspired by it or loved it.
And how did it feel to recreate such a memory with, because it sounds like it's such an intimate memory that you have with your family and having a tree, the tree involved and the tea involved, very intimate connection with family, and putting it into art with other people's eyes involved. How did it feel to recreate that, something so intimate with now with the eyes of spectators and people involved in the installation?
It felt, there was a powerful moment where I felt like I'm in Ireland, in Dublin. I have the privilege to have the voice and talk about my home through my art. And yeah, there was so many kind of political conversations under the jasmine tree. There was so many questions about which part of Gaza we were, or I had one Gazan girl who knew exactly where we were living, and then she was explaining the streets fully and mapping the city. And that was dystopian in its own way, as much as it's powerful and amazing to be part of the work. But it had a kind of dystopian side to it, that we're talking about a neighborhood or a city that was really affected by the genocide and demolished.
And it sounds really profound the way you say it has that sort of sense of you're replaying the memory, giving it to other people, and at the same time that it's dystopian in a sense where people are expressing the places that don't exist anymore, which is really profound in its sense. And how has that been felt by the Irish public so far?
Yeah, people perceive it. We really were like curious about it. It was January. It was cold. Mm-hmm. But luckily we had a good few people who joined me for the conversation because it connected. I think the tea was a big part of it too. We're like
a big tea culture. Here.
Yes. The tea was a seller for it. But yeah, people were supportive and amazing as usual.
That's beautiful. And it's great that there's a supportive environment in a new country that's is not necessarily your home, but there's people that support the work, the arts that you do, and that sense of place. And I want to ask you as well, because it sounds to me like place has a huge role in your work. What is your sense of place now?
I'll talk actually to answer this question. I think talking about my other project called Thread of Home, where we actually had a workshop earlier this year at Project Art Center, close around the same week of Meet Me Under the Jasmine Tree. And yeah, throughout these workshops where we teach about the history of the Huguenots and how rich the textile heritage from the 18th century, to kind of reflect on the modern time of displacement and exile, through to kind of be able to kind of connect that side, I chose embroidery and I chose linen to kind of connect the two. And embroidery in Palestine and cross stitch is very huge in history, where Palestinian women tell their own stories on their own dresses. So back in the day, you used to be able to tell where is she from her dress, from the colors that it's used. And it has a lot to do with like mapping the geography, which is I found fascinating as an artist. You would find like the coastal side where like bright colors, pink and bright orange, and the other side of Palestine, the West Bank, would have more darker red and dark orange, especially the Beit Lahem, one of the most beautiful dresses. So yeah, through that, there was connection, and through people who experiencing exile and experiencing forest displacement in Ireland, there was a connection. I was able to connect with people throughout this project, and they were able to connect while learning and making about both the Huguenots and Palestine.
That's beautiful. And it's really reminiscent of how art can be a tool for people when they're not physically placed in their home. It can be a tool for people to find a sense of place regardless of where they're from. So it's great to hear how your projects, whether it's the installations or the project involving embroidery, support people in a similar situation to find their sense of place again. Because a lot of people, when they're just living in their home environments that they've been raised in for all their life, they don't think about these things until they've been forced to leave.
Yeah.
So it's incredible to see how your work is supporting not only the conscious collective consciousness of Palestinian people in Ireland, but also supporting the learning of those who've never left Ireland for at all. And I want to ask you, like, how, especially for your own sense of self as an artist, you're pouring your heart into this. How do you cope with that? Because it's a huge emotional offload, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. Throughout like phone calls with my sisters in exile, we kind of vent sometimes. We're like, this is what happened to me. And this would be like one part of it. The other part is enjoying the nature in Ireland through swimming and photography of like beautiful spring or the Bloomsday. Like recently, I always find it grounding in a way of like to kind of have a moment and enjoy where you are. Also like through connecting with other friends who do similar practice, not only in Dublin, like in other parts of Europe or in the UK, we end up kind of having similar conversations about keeping going and how important for us to keep going, to keep the voice there.
and keep the stories alive and protect yourselves, you know, and it's so important to keep those stories alive and have having those people, like you said, your sister, to be there for you and just to sometimes just remove the professional hat off and be like, I'm having a bad day.
Yeah, exactly.
I hear you completely in terms of saying that. And even in moving forward, is there anything that you are ideating? I know the creative mind is huge. Is there anything that you are ideating right now or anything that you're thinking of doing that you'd love to share with us?
My mom always wanted me to be an international artist. So I'm planning to work towards that more, planning to kind of start touring around Europe, try to kind of visit some parts of the Middle East. I'd love to visit Cairo and do a short documentary. It's on my list about Palestinians who are forced to be exiled from Gaza in Cairo. So yeah, I want to work towards being an international voice.
And I think that's on the horizon for you based on everything that I've heard. So like, congratulations, Tuka, for all your work. It sounds like you're just doing such an incredible work in supporting or just even provoking people to think about stories of Palestinians, but supporting Palestinian people in terms of capturing or even preserving that collective memory, the bad parts and the joyful, the good parts and parts around freedom. So thank you so much again for coming on the show. And you can find Tuka's work at tukasaraj.com. After the break, we'll hear about Irish Music Residencies, supporting creators with autism to share their talents. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, music has become a way of making sense of the world. And today's guest is doing exactly that. Artist Haunt, also known as Dylan Ho, is an indie folk musician whose recent residency supported by Music Network in Cork explored not just songwriting, but how live music can become a more welcoming and inclusive space for autistic artists and audiences. He's here to tell us more about why that matters. Welcome, Dylan.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you tell us more about the residency itself and why it's important?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important, I suppose, to give autistic artists a platform and even kind of a safe space where I guess it's known that, you know, they have autism and what they're dealing with and that the people are kind of empathetic towards that and in the audience. I think it's an amazing initiative. I hope there's more of it in time to come.
And I know the residency was created or instigated by Music Network. Can you tell us what Music Network do?
Yeah, they're supporters of music nationwide. Yeah, they seem to instigate a lot of residencies and concerts and things like that. Yeah, they seem to do a lot.
Fantastic. And in terms of you collaborated with Music Network and you're an artist yourself. Where did that come from?
It's a mixture of everything and it's probably reflected in autism and ADHD and stuff like that. But it's literally like, I would call it indie folk, but there's elements of electronica, trad, jazz in there, and kind of all encapsulated in the songs. Yeah, it's a good mix of stuff.
That's beautiful. And I want to ask you, how has your experience being autistic shaped your music or your creativity as a whole?
I suppose, like, I was late to the game with my diagnosis. So, like, I was diagnosed about 3 years ago, and up until then, I suppose I always just felt different, and music was my way of, I suppose, trying to make sense of a lot of things and trying to process events, emotions, all that stuff, and yeah, to express it in ways that I probably wouldn't be able to otherwise. So, yeah, it's, for me anyway, it's a bit of a savior, I would say.
That's a fantastic way to describe it and a deeply personal way to describe it. Because maybe those who aren't in the creative industries, there's a difference between the creative industries and like the artistic practice of art, whether it's music, whether it's art, whether it's visual arts, whether it's film. It can be deeply therapeutic for people to express themselves. But I suppose with the industry or the creative industry or the music industry, do you think that they are kind of like understanding or open or engaging with those who are neurodiverse?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've always found it to be so, even if it's not directly said so. There's a lot of empathy in the arts. And I think people who get into music or you know, visual art or dance or any art discipline, I think they're kind of drawn to being sensitive and being empathetic and kind of being open to, I guess, people and feelings and all that stuff. And I think in general, anybody I've come across anyway has been very accepting and empathetic towards diversity and difference. And yeah, it's a very open career. Yeah,
that's fantastic. And maybe it's just a matter of fact of the evolving nature in terms of people being open to difference and being empathetic. It's really great to hear that your experience has been one that is positive. And in terms of your experience, how has things changed over the years in terms of the industry and how that openness has come to be?
I suppose, like, I wouldn't have been aware of it when I was starting out. Like, I started as a busker in Cork and, yeah, kind of met a lot of people through that. But it's definitely changed. Like, I even think the general conversation around neurodiversity and even general diversity, that's all changing and it's constantly progressing, I think, I hope. It seems to be. But, yeah, I think at the moment we're in an interesting space where there are things being developed and, yeah, being talked about, and, you know, we're all trying to figure out, I guess, how to make the world more accepting of everybody, really. And that'd be the ideal situation and scenario to be in, I think.
And that is the ideal, that everyone is treated fairly and equitably, considering all the differences that they had. And I know your own experience guides your practice in engaging with young people or other artists through the residency program. Can you walk us through perhaps maybe a workshop that you would conduct in the program or engage in the program?
Yeah, so we kind of worked in three different schools with groups of autistic children. So they would have been, I suppose, from the age of 7 and upwards, I would say, up to maybe 15, 16. And myself and guitarist Jim Murray, he was kind of helping me with the workshops also. And he was with Music Network. And yeah, we both kind of just went into these workshops fairly open with just, I don't know, the thought of bringing music to these kids, like letting them play the instruments, letting them join in if they wanted, or just enjoy it if they wanted. And even if it felt too much, they could leave and all that stuff. So it was very kind of, for me, it was eye-opening that I guess they enjoyed it so much, and that I suppose it wouldn't have been a regular occurrence for a lot of them. So I hope that sort of thing comes back around, you know, for giving workshops to kids like these. But yeah, it was brilliant. We loved doing it, and I think it was well received.
Well, that's great to hear. And great to hear the ages that you work with, because I suppose the difference between working a 7-year-old and a 15-year-old is vast. What did you see in terms of the difference?
Yeah, I suppose it didn't feel that different in terms, because I guess one group was the ages might have been like 7 to 9. It was a small thing, and then like a small difference. And then another group might have been like 7 to 16, so there was quite a big gap in the room and just with the school that was in. But yeah, it didn't feel like there was a massive difference or that there was a massive gap, because I think like music seemed to just connect everyone. Everyone was interested, and, you know, some kids were more interested than others, and, you know, there might have been a younger, like an 8-year-old who really wanted to play the guitar, and there might have been a 16-year-old who really wanted to play the accordion or something like that. So yeah, everyone was kind of invested in it, which is brilliant.
Well, that's beautiful. And especially for those who experience music for the first time, that they want to start, like yourself, use music as a tool to express themselves, to support themselves as they're developing, and to really understand themselves. And I suppose, especially for that young child like yourself that may be autistic, that doesn't have a diagnosis yet, that is learning about themselves or feels like the odd one out, what is advice you'd give them, Dylan?
I suppose for kids and even for parents of autistic children, I would say like music is an amazing tool to connect with the world, and like it's never, one, it's never too late, and two, like the expectations don't have to be vast, as in like you can be in music and not want to be a concert pianist or, you know, a performer even. You can enjoy it for the love of it and the art of it and, you know, the community of it even. So my advice would be just take part, and you might as well. you won't lose anything from not being in music, I think. It's a great thing.
That is fantastic. Well, thank you again, Dylan, for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Unified, supported by Commissioner Man. Find us on podcasts, on the Go Loud app, and share your thoughts with us at unified@newstalk.com. Thank you to Marais O'Sullivan for producing, and Aisha Neve on research. Join us again next week for more on Unified, Sundays at 8 p.m. on Newstalk. See you then.